Welcome back to Decades on Dirt Roads. This is Catherine.
And this is Maddie.
And we are finally back.
We're back. Season 2 is here. But just some updates from us. Wrapped up with fire season. Now in my off season. Life's good. We're just enjoying, not really doing much.
Don't say we.
Fair. It's just me. Catherine still has a job.
I'm still plugging away.
Yeah, she's still doing all of her stuff. But yeah, hunting season went good. It was a blast. A lot of good times in a wall tent.
And got a nice bowl.
Yeah, got a nice bowl this year. My sister's first bowl. She got that. Yeah, gosh. Just a lot of...
Yeah, a lot of running around.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a bowl tag. Was not lucky enough to get one, but I was able to be a part of one of my husband's buddies. Got one on opening day, and so it was really cool to actually be a part of that and be able to... see it skinned and pack it out and just like embrace and all of that hype. I've never seen the boys like that, so it's a really cool experience. So yeah, I got to help people pack at their elk, got to help people set up their camp, just kind of get more involved in it, which I really like. And then now it's cat season for me and my family of dogs and my husband, and so that's been super fun. I got one this year, which has been exciting. So, and we'll just segue that into, I am having the skull cleaned by one of our really cool friends. She is starting a skull cleaning business, Lily Barnes Skull Cleaning. Yeah. And so she's doing deer, elk, anything like that. And I will post a picture when I get it back officially and get it all set up, but it looks awesome. And she's just starting to nerd out on it. And I'm super excited for her. So,
yeah, friends supporting friends. She's got whatever, she's got her system, and she's super into it, and she's starting out. But yeah, if you are interested, and we'll include all those details in the show notes. But yeah, just a quality human all around, and she's located in LeGrand.
So we'll segue that into introducing Kyle. I actually met him through my friend who's a massage therapist. I guess they were chatting, and she's like, "Oh, you do this? Okay, here's my friend's number." And I slacked on getting to him because it was in the middle of my busy season, and finally got in contact with him. He was so on board. I think his big thing was he had never heard of forestry contracting when he was in school, and just like loves to be able to promote that flexible job and all that comes with that.
I mean, one, he was just a super cool, laid back dude. And just to hear the evolution of his career. Yeah, just pretty non-traditional in regards to like he took some significant gap years for some health issues, obviously. But then just the way that he found this super niche thing within contract forestry.
Which is actually way larger than we really realize.
Yeah, that's
in the scope of things.
Absolutely. And I think like, obviously I didn't know anything about the survey stuff that the FIA surveys, that's what it's called. I think the thing that I appreciated the most was him talking about his time in California working in like a very professional setting, mm-hmm. with that grant work that he did, and then how that translated to then doing all the survey stuff.
Yeah,
that
basically
he does
now. Running your own business. Well, he does run, not basically running his own business.
Yeah.
And being accountable for himself and, you know, getting all that work done that you're assigned at the beginning of the year, because it's a really loose timeline, so it takes a really motivated person to stay on top of that and finish it through even when some of your survey plot locations suck.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, the other thing that I had no idea about was the rules and regulation that you have to learn on the go.
Oh yeah, his Bible.
Yeah, the Bible that him and his wife ended up helping him out with. But that was, yeah, I thought it was just obviously a great way to start season 2 and just reconnecting with cool folks. Welcome, Kyle. Thank you for being here with us and joining us tonight. I guess we'll just start with kind of an introduction of yourself, and we'll go into the questions.
Sure. Happy to be here and share some of my experiences as a forestry contractor or forestry professional.
Yeah.
I grew up in Minnetonka, Minnesota, which is about 20 miles west of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and was really lucky growing up on Lake Minnetonka.
Wow.
Which is, I believe, referenced in Purple Rain.
Oh my.
Little Prince drop for you.
Wow.
As a Minnesotan.
Some pop culture. Very good.
But it was super cool growing up on a lake, fishing boat, and then down the street was a big tract of private timberland, which was mostly pine plantation. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my time as a kid, with I got one sibling, a younger brother. Mm-hmm. We spent a lot of time in those woods building forts and goofing off and whatnot.
Was it open access?
No. It was pretty lax, you know. I was born in 79, right? So I'm going to be 46 coming up. And I'd say like in the 80s and early 90s, you could just roam around freely in there. And then by the time I was in high school, they had active patrols. And,
yeah, you know, locking it down.
Things had changed, but that's kind of where I got my taste of just hanging out and playing in the woods. I grew up doing a little bit of hunting, but it was mostly upland game bird hunting in Minnesota, like pheasants and such.
Yeah, so totally.
Always had a passion for being outside fishing and hunting and whatnot. So went to college, made it easy on myself financially, stayed basically in Minneapolis and went to University of Minnesota, undecided.
How long were you undecided?
Number one slacker here. 3 years.
Oh my gosh.
I'm babe.
How long did it take you to graduate then?
6 years.
Ooh.
Full time. I've got 160 some credits. It was 120 for the degree.
That's a big stat for Kyle.
Yeah.
Big stat. Holy cow.
So yeah, I just kind of fumbled around in college for a couple of years trying to...
What were you taking, like...
Yeah, tell us the story of University of Minnesota.
Well, I got admitted to General College because I didn't specify a major. So mm-hmm. It's almost like a community college within the college.
Interesting.
Huh. I don't think they even have the General College anymore. But basically, you would go there and you could do a lot of your prerequisite work mm-hmm. For whatever major, right? So, yeah. Like, you'd get your creative writing done, you'd mm-hmm. get your art credit done, or psychology, whatnot.
Yeah, just those gen ed classes.
Yeah. And I'd say by the time I was finishing my second year, I kind of knew I wanted to be in natural resources.
Okay.
And then just continue on that path of, like, maybe forestry. And so took some classes in that, like dendrology mm-hmm. and... gosh, maybe soil science or something like that. And I was like, oh, this feels right. And then got in there, I think my fourth year, this is ridiculous.
Everyone's at their own pace.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. Some people know right off the bat.
A lot of my friends who I was in high school with also went to University of Minnesota, as you can imagine, right? Mm-hmm.
Right up the road.
And most, I feel pretty good making it that far, because a lot of them, you know, left to get jobs or whatnot.
Yeah, you're still in the fight, falls. Though.
Yeah.
You're still A number one. You don't know what you're doing yet, but you're still in the fight.
So it was in forestry my senior year, like, buckled down and basically went with an advisor, like, what is the quickest way out of school? And it was urban and community forestry for my degree. So I finished that, and I got a minor in forest resources, and that summer I graduated really late to the game, right? Because most of our colleagues or fellow professionals, I think when they're like 18 or 19 even, go into the Forest Service or do mm-hmm. some sort of summer,
some, in, yeah.
summer in, right? And I never did that. I just worked part-time jobs.
Yeah.
That I had during school and never, you know, and then the summer people would go off, do like the hot shot or whatnot.
Yeah.
But so I graduated and then got a job with the Forest Service as a step employee. Because basically I still had, it was like 6.5 years to graduate. I still had one credit I had to do, which was the introductory class to College of Natural Resources. So, like, learning how to use an email account.
Oh, no.
Oh, my gosh.
They made me take the one credit class, and it was only fall semester.
See,
But it worked out to my advantage because I could get this student temporary employment position.
Okay. Nice.
Which is what a STEP employee is, right? With the Forest Service. Was that
with like a certain department?
So I went to work for a state and private forestry, working for an entomologist doing emerald ash borer surveys. And that was the first summer of the emerald ash borer outbreak in the Midwest.
Whoa.
So it gave me a little taste of what's out there besides someone coming in as a professional and giving a lecture to class or professors telling you, right? Like,
totally.
And it was great because basically I got a travel account and a car and went to every state in the region to do these surveys.
Whoa.
And got to go to all the national forests, all the national parks, all the federal lands in that. And I was like, okay, I really like this. I'm traveling around, going to all these cool places, looking for bugs.
That's right? Awesome.
And I'm getting paid for it.
That's pretty cool.
Unfortunately, it was student temporary employment.
Yeah.
And then I graduated that winter, and then the following summer, I got hired full-time seasonal with the state of Minnesota, working for the Department of Agriculture as a plant health inspector.
Okay.
So completely...
What does that even entail?
Right. So completely different than forestry.
Yeah. It's
just, basically I got the job from my previous summer doing entomology.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this was I had a 5-county area, and every day I'd go out and survey random farm fields in each county. Basically I did a county a day.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you would post the results of your sweep net surveys on a public database so as agricultural producers could look at that data and go, oh, we're seeing a rise in such and such.
Mm. Oh, so you're still insects. Doing like net count, net yeah. stuff. Oh, still entomology based.
Yes.
Gotcha.
So that was a little bit different, but I really liked being in entomology, plant pathology. I was like, okay, maybe do I go back to school and pursue this or just... Anyways, that summer, I got sick. I was diagnosed with cancer.
At like 26?
I was, 25.
Oh my God.
And so, like, you know, your whole life just basically changes with that diagnosis. You're just concerned about trying to get rid of that and move on.
Yeah, definitely.
So, I had a gap in my employment there for a couple years after that, basically just living with my folks and trying to get through that illness, and had a friend going through the same thing, which was really weird because we grew up in the same area.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So, luckily, I got through that period, and that was the summer of 2007. I started looking for work again. And use all my available contacts like they tell you to, and nothing, right? And it's like July or something, so there's no summer jobs, whatnot.
Yeah.
And applying to all the jobs I did and that were like seemed interesting and forest related, I got a call back from Southern California.
Oh my.
On the San Bernardino National Forest.
Holy cow.
And did the interview. The interview went good. They offered me the job the next week. I was like, I'm taking it. I got to just get a job.
Fair.
And it's full-time, permanent. And so that August, moved to Southern California and the San Bernardino National Forest, which is like 80 miles from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Total change of scene for a Minnesota guy.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Coming from Lake Country.
Had you ever been to SoCal before?
I'd been down there on family vacation as a kid, like fourth grade or something. We went to San Diego, right?
Gotcha.
But
never like recruited there as like a young adult.
Didn't go down, check it out, nothing. Just loaded the car up with my dad and he drove down with me.
Yeah, send it.
And we had a fun road trip and got there and it was just... It's never like what it seems looking at Google Maps. you know?
Right.
Right. We're going up this mountain and it's all manzanita brush and all sorts of trees I can't even identify. I like, where's the dendro book?
Yeah, you are a fish out of water in SoCal at that point.
So that was like my first real job in forestry, though. And I was hired as a program coordinator, and the program was all about assisting landowners in defensible space. With the terrible, they had really terrible wildfires down there, I believe, in 2003.
Oh, so this is kind of the snapback from that.
And they're like, well, what can we do to help landowners? And for folks that don't know, the San Bernardino National Forest is the most densely populated national forest. There's like 90,000 private parcels in the forest.
That's an insane number.
Insane.
And you as the project manager are technically like in charge of being a liaison for that?
Yes. So we partnered with Forest Service and Cal Fire.
Okay.
And basically it was a neat little program. I shouldn't say little because it was huge, right? $10 million grant.
Yeah.
To start, I think they got another $10 million after I moved on. But basically, a landowner would call in, get information, and then we could send out a Cal Fire forester for no cost and evaluate the property. And if they so chose to pursue thinning their property, then we'd enroll them in the program, and they'd get a 75% reimbursement on the cost. So they still would hire a private tree company or forester to do the thinning.
Gotcha.
And then the state forester would go back out and inspect. And going into that, I kind of knew it'd be a lot of office work, maybe 90-10. Yeah. And it was more like 95-5.
Oof.
So it was a really good experience, though. I like coming into a professional office setting for the first time, really, as a 27-year-old. And working for two awesome women, like, I learned really quickly, like, oh, you're being an idiot. Don't say that.
you learned some manners pretty quick.
Yes.
Very good.
But they were cool about it.
Good.
You know, they'd pull me aside and be like, hey, what?
Yeah.
You know better? And I was like, I do. Why? And we did have some fun field days, like, especially when I started, right? The Cal Fire foresters took me out on a couple ride-alongs.
That's huge.
Which was really huge, right? So I could actually go, like,
see what the program's doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. And meet some landowners. And
absolutely.
And then, yeah, the director of the program, she took me out a couple times to just, like, show me around the communities. Because it's, you know, for a lot of folks that can't picture it, the national forests are big, and there's lots of little towns within them, and we were managing all of that, so.
Yeah, but ground truth it a little bit and say, oh,
exactly.
Okay, this is a 9-to-5, but in the grand scheme of things, like this is a lot deeper, especially with how catastrophic those fires can be for those communities, and I mean, it's indefensible to a certain extent, but to be a part of that preventative care that's huge. But I can't imagine sitting in an office and not being able to somewhat relate of just like, okay, this is what I'm doing it for.
Right.
Because so much of natural resources, it's instant gratification because you go and lay out a plot and it's like, okay, I was in the woods and I did this and now it's complete. But if you're in the office, you're not able to have that satisfaction.
Yes.
As you normally would in other natural resource positions.
So fast forward, I started in August, fast forward to October, I was able to relate very quickly. We got mandatory evacuations that second or third week of October.
Oh, wow.
And we were evacuated. Most of the communities up there were under forced evacuation. Mm-hmm. And that was my first time ever seeing a wildfire, was that morning. Having just moved there, I'd basically got everything out of my rental. I was renting a little cottage. Got everything out of it into the car in about 45 minutes. Skis, duffel bag, whatever.
Yeah.
It was in the car. And I had like a quarter mile drive to what they call the rim. You know, Highway 18, or I believe it's Highway 18. It skirts a major portion of those communities and the national forest. Gotcha. And I'm kind of living, you know, in the mountain woods, right? So I drive the quarter mile up to the highway and I look right to check for traffic. And that's the first time I'd ever seen a wildfire smoke column. And it was enormous. And I was like, oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we were evacuated for a week and it was really tragic. I think there were some residents that just didn't make it. I want to say, I'd have to look at the old newspapers, but mm-hmm. I think for sure over 100 homes were destroyed.
Yeah.
So we toured that and look, we got in and got to have a tour and, it was really like, it was a gut-wrenching tour because I'd never seen, you know, I'd never served in the military or saw combat, right? Mm-hmm. So I can't relate to that, but this was, or worked for the Forest Service on fire, but this was just crazy. Like,
oh yeah, it's
block after block, just
you just get leveled. That kind of sinking feeling, you know, when right. you see all that destruction.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, funny little story that we're doing the tour and there was a gentleman who had been a part of the program and we wanted to go up and interview him, even though we knew basically if you were in the program or not, right? It wasn't going to help you with this size of fire.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He was really a character because he was a retired school teacher who was an actor and had a bit part on Ally McBeal. And he's like 80 some years old. He's just the sweetest old man, right? And he's telling us that he really doesn't miss anything. He's like, if I could have got anything, it was like my baseball bat from being a little kid. He's like, you got it. At this point in my life, I just so grateful we got out of here, right? And it's just mm-hmm. touching in that way. And then he was telling us about his neighbor who he had talked to who got out. And the neighbor ignored the reverse 911 call by the sheriff's department for, you know, the mandatory evacuation. And I think he had been woken, you know, this is all at like 3-4 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And the sheriff knocked on the door to, as they're doing, running from the fire, basically doing yeah. the house checks that they do. And so he runs down to the neighbor runs down to his car with his wife. And he's backing out of the garage, and the fire is literally like 4 houses down the street.
Oh my god!
And he sees his golf clubs, and he jams his brakes on, and yells at his wife, "I gotta get the golf clubs
for the love of the game."
Yeah,
it never dies.
It's always funny those little things that like you're in like panic mode and.
But who would yeah, go for the golf and then he's like, clubs?
Probably just like saw them while he yeah. was backing out.
I'm sorry,
like,
that's the most skirt. That's the most middle-aged man thing. That's so legit. Like, photo albums? Golf clubs. I don't know, man. I'm going to see a lot more greens than I am probably those photos, so I should go grab those. You know, exactly. There's custom stuff on those. We can't be having a fire destroy that. But
so he had us, the guy, the old sweet old man who was telling all us, had us all laughing, which was a nice moment being yeah. there in like this moonscape.
Yeah.
Was there another year and a half after that, and it was really nice because I met my partner there.
Oh, that's awesome.
When she came to work, and that's how we met each other. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
But like I said, it was about 95% office work. And I really grew as a person and professionally. There was a lot of development there, especially with the mentorship.
Totally.
Right? Like, I didn't even know what Microsoft Access was. And by the time I left, I was basically managing the thing.
That's awesome.
And then, yeah, with like I said, with the phone banking and like learning how to talk in a professional way. You know, you think you, some people have it coming out of college or high school, but I did not.
You need more some more time.
Right, exactly. You know, I got good marks in school, and but speech was always hard for me. Like, giving a presentation in front of, even in front of 20 of your friends, right?
Yeah.
Just super nervous.
Yeah.
And that was part of the job, was I was forced to be a representative of the program at fire safe councils and workshops. So it was,
yeah,
because
you're pretty much like kind of recruiting people to join this program.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And yeah, that was a really great job, being so green as I was.
Mm-hmm.
I learned a lot. And I also learned that I didn't want to be in an office.
Yeah.
95% of my day.
Yeah.
Being in Minnesota, you know, it's, you know, February, and I go down there and it's 68 degrees. That was kind of nice, but
that's fair. There was some upside.
Otherwise,
yeah,
I was ready to move on and did, and gave them a month notice, and then basically was super selfish, still coming off my illness and first job, and wanted some me time. So I left in January and went ski bombing and bought a pass at Snowbird, Utah, and rented an apartment for 6 months with my brother. He quit his job too, and we we ski bummed till July.
Right on.
Till July.
Yeah, we were still skiing in June.
Oh my gosh.
You're in Utah though, right? It was like endless.
That was probably before it got super huge like it is now.
It was, I think it was, yeah, some of the last of the, it was getting busy, but nothing like
you don't
this.
Have to like make a reservation.
Exactly.
Like you do now.
It was nothing like it is now.
You don't have to pay a mortgage to go there.
Exactly. And bumming around central and southern Utah, because we were both unemployed, and, you know, if the snow wasn't good, or basically all of May and most of June, we were just gone Monday through Friday. Like, telling mom and dad we're looking for jobs, and we're just down camping.
Right. We're looking for jobs, mom,
yes.
On this river. Don't worry about it. We're on self-coverage.
Going down to Capitol Reef,
yeah.
And Moab.
It's
and,
a field
yeah.
day, mom. Come on. Let the boys play.
But it being 2008, with the financial crash,
oh gosh,
jobs just weren't there.
Yeah.
So that summer, I applied to roughly 200 positions. I got like 3 interviews.
Wow.
And I really thought I had a chance with the state of Utah in entomology, doing, I think it was something regarding like the, I don't know the name of it. I'm just going to say killer bee.
Yeah.
Right?
I believe you.
Something with like some killer bee that they wanted work done on, but
kind of like that killer wasp in like, what was that, 2021 that was going around in Western Washington?
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Like, they're like 2-inch bees from like,
oh, those things,
the
yeah.
Asia that were, yeah, they started coming. You, Maddie, you never heard about them?
No.
Oh my God.
I don't like to think about that because we're all out in the woods.
Yeah.
They're
half
not,
the time
they're
by
not
ourselves.
Here, but they were starting to find them in like Western Washington.
Ignorance is bliss, baby.
Yeah. Anyways, sad.
So it was really, you know, I got some good opportunities. It just didn't work out. I'm pretty sure it was super competitive, right?
That,
going against
yeah.
folks with masters and whatnot for the same low-level positions. So, yeah, our lease ended and we moved back home to Minnesota with the folks that August. And I looked for work all that winter. And it was tough, and I just wasn't, you know, I probably should have just taken a job to have a job, mm-hmm. you know, doing something to get a paycheck, but I was stubborn. And it was in March that I was on the job board of University of Minnesota Forestry Department, and there was a goofy job listing, like, and it was all geared towards how much money you could make. And I was like, what kind of scam is this? Right?
Interesting.
And I sent in my cover letter and resume and got an email back. When could I start? furthering my suspicions of what kind of scam is this.
Yeah, that was a quick turnaround for trying times.
So, never did talk to the owner on the phone. He just got an email correspondence going. And to meet some of his fellow subcontractors on the Chippewa National Forest that April. And an equipment list of stuff I would need to buy to go to the job. I'm going, oh gosh, I don't have any money, right? I'm living at home on credit cards with my parents.
Yeah.
So I talked to my folks about it and I'm like, well, let's get you set up, right? So they're super helpful and got me my first Spencer tape and increment bore and compass, prism, and clinometer.
Those very expensive forestry specialty items.
Yes. Yes. For folks that don't know, a 12-inch increment bore is about $300 currently. So.
And they like to break.
Classic. So I went up and it was first week of May in Matt, in northern Minnesota too. It's just that time of year. It's, you know, spring's coming in. So you get really nice days and really meh days.
Yeah.
And some of the small towns are just old, small logging towns, right? And yeah, met another couple who'd been working for this contractor as subcontractors for about 6 months. And then another University of Minnesota graduate. She had not had a job in forestry. She just graduated. And yeah, we met at a bar that night and we had a great time. And then the next day we went out and trained. And that's basically, I'd had a forestry summer camp for 3 weeks. But that was, you know, 5 years before this. And so I'd forgotten even like what a plot is. And how to spin a plot and how to basically inventory the forest.
Mm-hmm.
So got trained in on that and then was provided maps with a chunk of work. And of course it was from the previous summer that the previous crew had not finished. So it's always the junk, right? So I'm going out as a greenhorn, hiking like a mile down power line corridors,
yeah, so it's out like through a swamp. One over here. Super spread out.
I never forget, like the first day as a subcontractor, I made $100. It wasn't my first day. I'm just saying the first day I made $100 and I was like, sweet.
Yes.
I made $100.
That's a win.
Yeah.
We needed a win.
So it was a slow process. We finished that junk up from last year. I was just so grateful to have a job, though. Not working for almost 2 years.
Yeah.
It just felt really good to work. And then we got a new contract that summer on the Chippewa National Forest. And we finished that, like, the last week of June. And it worked out well. My family has friends up there. So I was able to stay with family friends and an old pop-up on their property, and it was like 5 minutes from work. So it was really unusual in that case, I would soon learn, right? Because most of the time you can't stay where you work if you want some sort of digs.
Yeah.
But yeah, then from there, went to the Superior National Forest, was paid to get my cruiser certification through the Forest Service.
And what is that?
So that is, gosh, it's been so long and you don't need to renew it. I think you do now, but at the time you never needed to renew it. You just need to get field checked. Okay. I think they call it a cold check. Gotcha. But basically cruiser training is a 3-day course for contractors and Forest Service employees on it. The course varies depending on the region, right? So I think Great Lakes is region 9. Anyways.
You should know that. You spent...
Yeah, because isn't region 8's down south. So then is it region 9?
And where are we here?
Region 6.
Region 6. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anyways, so the region 9 cruiser training basically was 2 days of classroom training. Everything you learned in forestry school. Just refreshed on how they want it. Where do you measure a forked tree? You know, what is diameter at breast height? And what is the proper way to take a height on a tree that's leaning? And anything you would encounter. And then a big component of it, though, was the marking. Like how to properly check out paint, return paint, how to store paint, right? Because the tracer paint is such a big deal with log theft that they're really like on, you can't lose a can of paint or you're in big doo-doo.
Yeah, the inventory process for that is pretty crazy. Remember the timber building in the Bakerfield?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have, it's like under like 3 locks and keys.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And like only one or two of the timber guys has it.
Of course, I went on to meet a guy who was on a marking project in South Carolina that lost a can of paint. And that's a different story that I don't remember. But so it was 2 days of classroom and then a day of being checked in the field. So you had to pass an examination of measuring 100 trees. And the night before the examination... this is all in Ely, Minnesota, which is on the Boundary Waters. It's a.
I've been there.
Have you been to Ely?
Yeah, we went to Ely last spring. We went there for 20, or we went there for a roll, but we were there for like 20 days.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Ely.
Yeah, it's Ely.
A cool, funky little.
Yes.
Outfitter Voyager town.
Very
for
much
the
so.
Canoeists.
Yes. Oh my gosh, packers. We learned how to canoe.
Yeah.
We went and saw the planes on the lakes.
Sure.
And it was an out-of-body experience. Like, whatever. Just coming from this area, and then it's like...
Very different.
Very different. Mm-hmm. And it was weird because I felt like a tourist, but I was working. And it got very real. They're like, no, like, if you guys, like, go on a fire, the only way in is to canoe. It was like...
Right.
What do you mean? I don't get it. I got our trucks right here. We can just drive. And it's like, no. There's no roads.
So no roads.
Figure this out. So the team working and the team building exercises that occurred on the canoes made it very real in our roster. Of like, okay, who's actually calm?
Yeah.
And who
can swim?
Who can swim? Who can steer? Who can be a machine? And who is a liability? So Ely, awesome. Minnesota, I've been there. I know where you're talking about.
Very few people around here have even heard of it. That's cool.
Yeah.
So we're in this cool little resort town, Ely, and the night before the examination is Saturday night, and what do? Is a bunch of late 20-year-old contract foresters.
Hit this bar.
We went to the bars and got absolutely blasted. Just blasted. And the next morning, I remember, I probably still reeked of booze. And... we had to go measure 100 trees, and I'm still relatively new at the forestry deal, right? You know, we've been working for about 6 weeks.
You must have been sweating.
Yes. Yes.
Sweat out the beers. Sweat out the beers, please.
And it's a couple of old school forester guys who are super cool, and what happens with that? You end up talking all morning.
Yes.
So here it is. Getting late, and they're like, oh, okay, just go measure your 100 trees. Like, I have 35 years of experience to do this, you know. I'm slow in my ways at that point. And, yeah, at one point, we just teamed up.
Went 0 to 100.
Grabbed my friend. I was like, get over here. You do diameters. I'll do heights. Yeah. Let's get this over with. We're same answer, everything.
Yeah. We're in this together.
Yes. So... that was a kind of cool deal because, you know, again, I just started work and I was really excited. I made $100 in today. Well, the contractor paid us to go to that 3-day deal and I made $500 a day. I was like, oh my gosh, really?
So his ad wasn't lying.
Right, exactly. And then, so we get done with that and he's, you know, I call him and how's it going? And good. And, well, I really don't have any work for you.
Mm. The bad part of contract forestry.
And luckily it wasn't too long, a couple of weeks, and he calls and it's like, I want you to head on down to my house. Sure. I'm not even gonna say it. Cloudcroft, New Mexico, which is about 80 miles north of El Paso, Texas, as the crow flies.
Cool. I think I've been there.
So super. Wait, so
you're going from Minnesota
to pretty much right. Texas.
So basically a long day driving, sleep in the car, long day driving.
It's got to be at least over 20-hour drive.
Yeah, it was brutal. And got down there. They were in northern New Mexico. And that was the first time I'd heard of the FIA program. Because the FIA crews had a big house rented in Angel Fire, New Mexico. So that's where I met the guy who had hired me over an email like 5 months before.
It all comes around.
So I finally got to meet Joel, who was like the most crazy character in forestry you'll ever meet. And I had not met anyone there except for the folks who trained me in Minnesota. They were already down there. And got in again. It was a Saturday night. What do? Go out, get blasted. And I'm with the guy who hired me over an email I had never met. And like,
let's party.
Is this okay? Because he's sober. And I'm like, is this cool that...
You're like, I remember all this professionalism from my last
job. Yeah. And here I am getting blacked out drunk. What is going on here? But it was really fun. At one point, we were riding in the back of his pickup on the way home from the bar because he had bought us all shots. And I was like, okay, I think I found my job. This is fun.
I think I can do this.
And then, the next day, I drove down to the southern part of New Mexico and got set up with him again to finish a contract that no one wanted or someone didn't finish or something. And that was a really long 3 weeks. And a big part of being a contract forester is that to make it lucrative, it's ideally you're sleeping at the job site in a camper or the truck, or God forbid, camping, right? I brought my tent and I learned real quick, you sleep in the car. It's just,
especially that far into the desert area.
Yeah, and way faster breakdown in the mornings, mm-hmm. and then at night you're not dealing, and you're not leaving it there in the woods for someone to rummage through your stuff.
Do you have to build out your pickup or something?
So at the time I had a Volvo station wagon.
They actually fold down pretty nice.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I mean, when you're 30.
Yeah, it worked. It did. And so got down there, and that was, I'd done some camping in Minnesota, and it was I still remember my first night alone in the car, just on a forest road, parked, on a
minimum. It's weird.
It was really weird.
It's really weird.
Constantly thinking someone was like up in my window looking at me.
Yeah. And there they become eyes everywhere.
Exactly.
Everywhere you look, you're like, I feel something. It's really just the wind, but it might be something. It could be something that could kill me.
Took about 5 beers for me to fall asleep. Let's just say that much. But yeah, down there. And so I'm still getting used to like the routine of car camping and living out of a car in another state now. And not having the resources I did in Minnesota with friends and family, or I could just make a call.
Totally.
And it was 3 weeks, and it was New Mexico monsoon season. So every day we got drove out of the woods by like noon or 2 o'clock. Just these big thunderheads rolling in. And that was on the Lincoln National Forest. And it's really an island in the sky, they call it, right? So you come up from the White Sands missile base mm-hmm. in the desert, and you go up like 5,000-6,000 vertical feet to this rolling hilltop forest that's very similar to our elkhorns. Really? It's like aspen, lodgepole, ponderosa, Doug, not grand fir, white fir, right? It's really pretty. And very dry, though. Not a lot of creeks, not a lot of, hardly any water bodies. Just ephemeral, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, those 3 weeks were trying because of the rain and then the work. You know, I started that job in Minnesota and it was cruising quick plots, they call them. And a quick plot is just using, out east we use prisms, mm-hmm. and not rel scopes. And you're basically just counting a 2-inch diameter and the height of the tree, species, live or dead. And that's your plot. And then a regen plot, right? A fixed radius regeneration plot to see what's coming in. Mm-hmm. So very basic.
Quick.
Quick. Real quick. Just get data real quick so they can see if they need to go in there and thin or what's coming up, basically. Or do we need to harvest? And this was a whole different ballgame. It was fixed radius plots, 1/5 acre. I think it was 1/5 acre.
Isn't that like
52.8 feet.
Yeah.
And they had you they had you putting a tree tag into each tree, like the FIA program. Mm. Which I mentioned the party house that I stopped into first, and that's where I first had heard of FIA, the Forest Inventory and Analysis Program, and had gotten a little bit of it that night when we were drinking, like, what do you do mm-hmm. on plot and whatnot. And so then I went to this and was like, oh my gosh, this is what they're doing. But I knew they made a lot more money. These were paying nothing, right? So mm-hmm. it was really challenging the work, but got through it. And again, still just super happy I'm making any money at this point, having a job. And yeah. Down in New Mexico, cool. Mm-hmm. Finished that and then went to the White Mountain National Forest. No. The White Mountains in Arizona. It's the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest.
Okay.
And that's on the eastern part of Arizona. And you don't realize it coming from at least where I grew up in the Midwest and looking at a map, but you go to New Mexico and Arizona and it's the 4th and 5th largest states. They're just huge. Just huge. So we got to the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest and the couple who had trained me in knew we were coming with the girl I was trained in with. And we had a sweet rental house because it was 2008 and everything was in foreclosure. And we found like this mansion on a private golf course, this gated community. So we're coming back in Carhartts, right? And like hitting the gate button.
Rolling in with your muddy car.
Yeah.
That's a vibe. Oh my gosh.
But that was also a common stand exam by the National Forest Service. And a little bit more intensive, though, in the data we're collecting.
I've done those.
And it was, again, another stepping stone for me in contracting, just learning something new and more intensive and new species, new area. And it started to finally click where I was making a little bit of money and the work was really good. Like, I've not been back there since and would kill to be down there every fall because it's so beautiful and...
That'd probably be the best time to be over there.
Yeah, and so the White Mountains, the forest surrounds the Apache have their land, and it's pretty much surrounded on two sides at least with the National Forest. Mm-hmm. And their land is known for some of the best elk hunting in the world. Like the biggest bulls in the world come from those mountains. Mm. And so one morning... And I was told this going down there, but I'm not an elk hunter, so I was like, I'm not really
jazzed. You're like, yeah, whatever.
Whatever.
This doesn't really affect me. Cool.
But right. The guy I'm working for now, Joel, who's this character, right? He's like, guy, you're going to love it down there. They got the biggest bulls in the world.
He's hyper for you. He's hyper.
He's super hyper. So it doesn't really, you know, and I'm like, elk, whatever, I've seen an elk, and not, right? So I'm going to plot, going to work one morning, like 6 in the morning, and I've got a stand of aspen, and it's full of blowdown. It's just ugly in there. Like, to get to the plot, it was a real challenge, just to get to the first plot. And I'm fighting through, it's probably, you know, like 7 in the morning at this point, so sun's still just kind of coming up at that time of year, and I'm fighting through this kind of variable, patchy, understory brush with down logs all over. So I'm hurtling and going under and...
just sucks.
Right. Sweating, trying to get to the first plot, and literally look up, and I'm about 35 feet from the most amazing bull elk I've ever seen in my life. The thing was huge, and that's when I was like, oh...
this is what they're talking about.
Oh, I hope you go that way. Yeah. Go that way.
Yeah.
So it just looked at me, and we kind of had a stare off, and then just gingerly went the other direction.
He said, you're a friend, not a foe.
And I was like, oh, thank you. And I've had a lot of moments like that. Now I look back in my career where, like, if the animals had really wanted to have their way, mm-hmm. you know, I would be...
gone.
Gonski.
But we'll keep it at a magical moment.
Yeah.
Pretty neat.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was kind of did it for me. Like, I'm going to stick with this job for a while. Was those two projects in Arizona. And we finished, like, in Thanksgiving. I went home and there was still work left. And he was trying to get me to stay. I was like, no, I'm done for the year. And then had saved just enough where I could run right back to Utah and go ski bumming for another year.
Priorities.
Yes.
Boy.
And then, yeah, the second year, that summer, still had not made the investment in buying a laser. So I was still going... for folks that don't know, to measure a tree height, you use a clinometer. Mm. And to use the clinometer to get an accurate height, you've got to jump back 33 feet, 50 feet, 66 feet to shoot your height. And then a lot of times you'll get a baseline on a good height measurement and estimate your other ones, professional estimate, right? But mm-hmm. So anyways, the leader of the project was from Colorado, and he was harping on us all summer to invest in a laser. Well, at the time, I think there's even more money now, but they're $800, right? Jeez. And it's like, oh gosh, I just laid out all that money last summer for my initial investment. And then, you know, being in the woods every day too, you quickly learn, like, you got to buy expensive boots and buy two pairs of expensive boots.
Yeah,
and
those are your wheels.
And I knew from skiing, good clothing, you know, always buy top-of-the-line Gore-Tex stuff and, you know, PVC rain gear and whatnot, right? But, so, went without a laser that summer. So, it's just, we did the math one night drinking beers. Like, how many extra miles had we walked just shooting heights? Right?
Another dark stat for college. Yeah. Talk about 160 credits in college. Add on the added miles.
Oh, no.
Always the hard way with... Yeah. With Kyle here.
Oh, gosh.
So, finished that project up, did another thing of ski bumming, and then came back to finish that project the next year and bought a laser first week. And it increases your productivity like 3 to 4 times.
That can be your end of the podcast tip.
Yeah.
Get the right tools.
Yeah. Buy the laser.
That's what Save miles and money.
Yes. Yes. I had a professor, he would call it the laser. That's because when I was in forestry camp, it was 2003. And a laser at that time was like $2,600. And it was like this big.
Heavens.
Probably like 10 pounds.
Big 10 pound clunky thing you had to set up on a tripod.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That would not have been worth it.
No.
No.
Something like rangefinder-esque where you're just like...
Yes. So that was a good summer for me. I was actually able to like get ahead, which is hard working seasonally, to make a little bit of money to like save and then go go ski bumming again. Back to Utah.
Yeah.
And the following summer, I don't recall where I worked. I think it was back in Minnesota. And that was the case for like the next 3 or 4 field seasons. It was like summer work. And then instead of ski bumming, I tried to line it up where the guy I was working for, Joel, he was getting projects on Native American land in New Mexico and Colorado. Mm-hmm. And so the BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they do an inventory program that is similar to the Forest Service's FIA program. Mm-hmm. Except theirs is called CFI. And the Forest Service used to do CFI. It's Continuous Forest Inventory. And that was, like, besides those few plots I did starting out that were fixed, these were like the first real fixed plots I got into. Those were a lot of fun. And then the Taos Pueblo in Taos, New Mexico, he got that contract. And so we went down there and I was really not up for it because they were insisting on having a tribal liaison with you
at all times.
And I'm like, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me. I can't, you know, at this point, 5 years into the gig is what I call it. Yeah. I don't call it a career or a job. It's a gig.
Yeah.
I feel like a musician, really. Yeah. I'm like, I'm so independent and
you've got your flow.
Set my ways and I'm, right, exactly. I need to be alone and just,
yeah.
So it's like, okay, I'll go do it. I don't want to do it. And it turned out to be one of the best experiences of my life to be on their land where this was the first time they had inventoried it.
Wow.
I was told they'd been inventoried before, but I wasn't quite sure. About that.
Yeah.
But yeah, they, the Taos Pueblo people are just amazing. And they were the first tribe to get their sacred lands back through the courts in like 1960 or early 60s.
Wow.
They had won in the Supreme Court and gotten all their sacred lands back from the Forest Service. So it's just this amazing place, really. And there were,
so I get why they would probably want that.
Yes.
Liaison there.
Yes, and it was really unique because I never quite figured it out, but there was always a gentleman in there, an older gentleman, when I'd go into the Pueblo DNR to like pick up work or drop off work, and occasionally this older gentleman would be there, and he just had this, you know, some folks just have an aura or a feeling you get, and mm-hmm. you could tell this person was a very special person, and he'd be in there consulting with the DNR, and then we were told, oh, you can't go in this zone for the next 3 weeks. So I'm assuming he was like a spiritual leader or a medicine man.
Oh, gotcha.
And they closed down certain parts of their lands yeah. to all, even members of their own community, to all people, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, got to learn a lot about, a little bit, a peek into like life on a Native American reservation, how much different that is compared to just a normal upbringing in suburbia, Minnesota.
Yeah.
And anyways, there were 70 wilderness plots and that was on a grid pattern. And there, I believe it was 1/2 mile between each plot.
Mm-hmm.
So just basically the whole mountain range.
You got to see it all.
And I did 70 of the 80 wilderness plots I did. So at one point, you know, we're using pack horses to go in.
That's so cool.
Like 8, 12 miles, set up camp.
Yeah.
And
this is still with the liaison?
So the liaisons turned out to be the best part.
Yeah.
You know, I'm in this amazing place, but then I have them and they're the coolest bunch of dudes.
That's awesome.
You know, just so cool. And they were all, they call their fire team the Snowballs, Taos Pueblo Snowballs. So I was a honoree, inductee into the Snowballs. I got a t-shirt that year, yeah.
That's awesome.
So I got to work with like 6 or 8 different guys, and they really got to pass on my skills to them. Like, so on the FIA program and on these BIA CFI plots, you do a Brown's transect, which is a fuels line to measure fuels. So as you know, a fire manager can be like, oh, they've got X amount of tons of 1 hour fuels or 10 hour fuels, 100 hour fuels. Well, it's pretty cool. Those guys had never done those surveys, and their skills regard, you know, just in general with like scientific measurements were kind of lacking, but I got to show them like, this is, you know, got to walk them through the whole plot, but then especially fuels, which was good for them going forward in fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we had a lot of fun, and they helped me so much, and I really grew, you know, I was like 36, 37 years old at this point, and I still like got to grow a lot as a person that summer working there with them, and feel very blessed still to this day to like be in some of the only Anglo eyes to see it since they won that land back in the 1960s.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Their sacred spots.
A lot more meaning than just a project. Like, that's very spiritual, obviously.
Yeah.
For them, and then for you as the person that's going in, you can go in with just a scientific mindset. And, yeah, this is just another gig, but I'm sure that was probably pretty transformative, just, like, whatever, soul-wise and human-wise.
Yes.
To be with them and, like...
Absolutely.
That's, yeah, what an honor.
That's pretty cool. So, it was cool leaving there with a deep bond with those guys, and to be, you know, like they have quite a few things throughout the year that the community gets around, but like Feast is one of their big ones, and I think it's called Feast. It's not Fest. But anyways, I was invited to like by multiple members of the community to come to our deal, because the Taos Pueblo is like literally this giant pueblo, and each family still has like their spot, or their you wouldn't call it an apartment or something in it, right? But their rooms, mm-hmm. basically. And yeah, for Feast, I was getting invites to come to ours, come to this, and I was like, oh, this is so amazing. And yeah, invited to the powwow multiple times throughout the year, and yeah,
that's very really neat.
So basically, that same, we were finishing up that project that same year. FIA kept getting tossed at me by Joel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when are you going to come work FIA? And I would always tell him, well, I have no interest in it. I'm doing just fine financially working the easier work. And he's like, no, come try this. And so... that's basically how it transitioned to me getting to Eastern Oregon. Was the following year, a guy, Kyle, who had worked for Joel, had been out here since 2010 doing the Forest Service FIA contracts.
Yeah, do you want to talk a little bit, like explain that a little bit more? Like kind of like the history behind it and like kind of...
So from what I know,
yeah,
it was started, I believe I got this off of YouTube. There's a YouTube video on the Alaska FIA program, which is really intense.
Oh, I bet.
Right? Because it's...
anything Alaska-wise, not
that really intense.
Yeah.
Anything.
I believe I watched the YouTube video, though, and in that, the... Forest Service representative, she was saying, I think it started in the 1920s out east. And so it's a nationwide program of fixed, permanent plot locations that get inventoried every decade, once every 10 years, so as they can see what's happening at a landscape level with vegetation, really. Mm-hmm. Right? So, you know, it's had many different, the nomenclature's changed and the specs of the data have changed and the survey parameters, right? But it's basically the same thing, like going to these locations every 10 years to get data so as they can track change, is how I understand it.
Gotcha.
And now it's pretty cool. Now that data is actually being used for carbon.
Yeah.
To see what kind of carbon is being sequestered. So as they can model that with anything they want, really, right?
But are these plots like marked? Is it like a rebar, like a survey point? Or is it just, they are, okay.
Right, so basically, there's a folder associated with each location.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's been measured previously, you will have obviously the GPS coordinates and then a travel description on how to get there via roads and foot. And then it will have all the previous tree data and vegetation data. And you go, basically, you get your data packet and, okay, I'm going to go to such and such to inventory this tomorrow. And then you'll kind of get a game plan and get out there. And yeah, it's, I've heard stories, people not finding them, but it's pretty.
I mean, that sounds like a lot of information in a packet.
Yeah. Yeah. They're pretty good to find because they are monumented
mm-hmm.
outside of the wilderness. In the wilderness, they aren't monumented, but they're painted. So it gets a little tricky. It's got like brown or gray paint.
Super easy to find then.
Yeah. Right. Especially if it's low light and you're trying to race to get it done. But yeah, the plot center. So there's on an FIA plot, there's actually four plots. They call them subplots. And so you get to the first one, which is, you just call it plot center, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be monumented. There's a rebar stake in the ground and then a wood stake with a yellow pin on it. Or like a yellow flasher or whatever you want to call it. We just call them rounds, I think. And so you literally, sometimes you just, a lot of times you'll come to what you think is the plot with the GPS and you might be within 30 feet, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you'll see that little yellow tag on the ground and you're going, oh no, because you've got to reestablish the plot center then.
Mm-hmm.
So they use witness trees or reference trees, whatever you'd like to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And typically they're at a 90 degree angle of each other, right? So mm-hmm. you can crisscross and you've got,
they have like the 30 feet at 180 bearing.
Exactly.
And, yeah. Like exactly. A survey corner.
And those are monumented as well at 6 feet. Huh. So you're literally just going into the woods and with your GPS, unless it's on the road, unless mm-hmm. it's a roadkill, and you're just looking for those orange tags, really. And then you go, oh, okay, plot center's over here. So that's basically what you're looking for to get out there. And then, yeah, there's that plot, and that's a 24-foot radius plot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this all changes depending on the region. But for us, it's 24 feet and then out to 50. I'm going to butcher this, and people are going to laugh if they know
they've done it. We don't have to get into the specifics of the measurement.
Anyways, there's a bigger plot where you measure 24-inch trees and up.
Mm.
The big tree plot. And then there's also the regeneration plot that you'll do. And then you'll do those Brown's fuel lines to get fuels data. And then you also do a vegetation survey. So you're identifying.
So there's a lot of data.
A lot of data. Mm. Yeah, it can be very time consuming, especially if there's a lot of diversity.
How frequent are these plots? Like one every 10 acres?
Or
are they just like kind of random?
They're really kind of, I'm sure there's a grid or something they use, but they're really kind of random. And it depends, again, on the region. Like, so, for example, when I met those folks in New Mexico for the first time and they're telling me about the FIA, well, it was the entire state.
Okay.
And so they would just break it up like, oh, I'm going to go do 10 plots in the Northeast and you go do 10 plots down here or whatever. So you could be in kind of like not driving all over, but you're still doing a lot of driving.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I wasn't interested in to...
Yeah.
To make a good paycheck, you've got to sometimes drive all night to the next spot.
What about in this area, like on the Willamette?
So this is a little bit better, I would say, in terms of that, because, again, it's random, but they call it Area 7. So it's the Malheur, the Willamette, and the Umatilla.
So kind of like a tri-forest area.
Those are just the three forests I was working in here while I was doing this for Kyle. And the, I'd say the normal summer day, unless it's a lot of trees, you should find yourself on two plots. You know, starting, getting a plot done by noon or two.
Yeah.
And then driving to the next plot. But as you know, some folks might not at home, but that the next plot might only be on the next ridge, but to get to that next ridge might take you 4 or 5 hours in the car, plus hiking. And then throwing Hell's Canyon.
A moment of silence.
Yes, please.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Happy Valley, as we call it. Yeah.
Certainly.
So came out here in 2018, and my partner, Megan, she was working remotely out of Portland, and we had just bought a camper, and we were living in the camper, and we came out here, and she wanted to get involved with it, too. So she came on with me that summer, that first summer I was doing FIA, and I'm glad I had someone to share the suffering, because it was brutal.
Really?
Brutal. Coming from those BIA plots and knowing everything to this was a whole new ball game. And we called it the Bible because the Forest Service gives you a 330-page spiral notebook of protocol you must follow to conduct the survey. And a lot of it is straightforward stuff, basic force measurements, but a lot of it too was all new to me because they do a what they call a condition class. So you're literally classifying the land, and if there's any change within the land that's an acre in size or greater, it's a different condition. So it worked out, we got through it, but it was a long summer in 2018 out here. We didn't see rain, I don't think, till the end of September. And working in Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, I'd never seen dry like here in Eastern Oregon, where
it's a weird place.
The back of the truck, at one point, even with the topper on it, was so disgusting because it just couldn't keep the dust out. It was so gross. Yeah, we went to recycle the Coors cans one day that had amounted through the summer.
Yeah.
And we're like, maybe we ought to just find a recycle place. These aren't even worth getting the money. This was that bad.
Oh, gosh.
Learning those new protocols in the Bible.
Yes.
With my partner, who also was, her background, she went to NAU and Northern Arizona University, and was communications major, but she had worked on a fire crew for 2 summers.
Okay. Oh, cool.
And her mom, her dad, and her stepdad are all foresters.
Oh.
Forester family.
Forester family.
Dang.
And her stepdad was the state silviculturist.
Holy cow. For the state of Oregon.
Yes.
Wow.
Oh.
Holy cow. Runs in the blood.
So she knew what she was getting into.
Yeah.
Right? She knew the lifestyle.
Knew the lifestyle and a little bit about, being in the woods, which was nice. But it was a, you know, a challenge to learn for me, and she's just coming on. So basically we broke it down. Like, I trained her on the fuels protocols, and then she was big on like helping navigation and like finding the plot and getting things set up. So I'm really grateful she was with that summer. I don't know if I would have stuck with it, honestly.
Yeah. Because, shout out to Megan.
Yeah.
You're real.
Thanks, Meg. But we data recorder you use to collect the data, you have to use a Windows-based program. But anyways, I was provided equipment, so I didn't have to invest in those expenditures my first year, not knowing if even we were going to stick with with these kind of plot. And it was the oldest piece of junk, and the thing would glitch all the time. So you'd be nervous that you lost all your data. And it was just a nightmare.
Zero anxiety, though.
It wouldn't turn on for me one day.
Did you figure that out before or after you hiked in?
Yes.
I don't remember. I don't want to remember.
He blocked it out.
The Budweisers are blocking it. Yeah. We didn't even hit our production goal with the two of us. And it was a tough summer. I was like, I'm never going back. That's it. Get me out of here. And I was like, gosh, I'm going to give it another shot. And we came back up here and Megan was out. She's like, no way.
Yeah, Northeastern Oregon's not for me.
And I had made just enough to justify down in Arkansas in Texas that winter to justify buying the data recorder.
So see, buy the tools.
I bought the tool and it was so much better. And I knew a little bit more coming into it. And so much of FIA too is knowing the terrain. Like where, like looking at a map and how to get to a certain section of the forest is crucial. Mm-hmm. So the second season went a little bit better, and then yeah, stuck with it. And here I am. This was the first season I did not do it.
So you guys settled here, staying in Northeast Oregon, or you?
So yeah, the third or fourth season working for Kyle on Eastern Oregon FIA, all those other summers we'd been in the camper, and Megan had a place in Portland. So I'd run back there like every 4 or 5 weeks, right, for a week. Mm-hmm. But was like, okay, I'm going to rent a place. And this was coming out of 2020 and COVID, right? So like it was spring of 2021. And I'd spend a bunch of time, mostly when we had the camper in La Grande, we would just stay at the Hot Springs RV resort. Mm-hmm. It was super convenient. And only time I'd come into Baker was basically on my way to work and getting gas or stopping at Ace Hardware to get something for work. I was like, every time I went through there, it must've been in the weekend. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I can't handle it here. I got to get out of here. Like the 4th of July crowd kind of deal.
A lot of parades.
Right. So the only rental I could find that spring was in Baker. Nothing was available in the Grand.
College town.
Right. Of course, tough to find one at Baker too. It was expensive, but I was like, I need a home base. And within a week of living there, I was like, I'm getting a realtor. I called Megan. I was like, I'm getting a realtor. I like it here.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And yeah, we started looking at places and got lucky and found a home. So yeah, I love as a downhill skier and just avid outdoors person. Really lucky to be here. The community in Baker, super nice.
Oh, yeah.
People are cool.
Yeah.
Like, they don't care, like, what you look like, what your ideology is. If your car is broken down, they're going to stop and ask you, like, you need help. Like, I've never had a problem here, like, with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a cool place to be an outdoorsman, especially. Like, whatever. You've got the Elkhorns here. You've got the Eagle Caps.
Yeah.
You've got Seven Devils.
And so much to...
Yeah.
And I've been blessed with the job of FIA. Like, I've learned every nook and cranny.
What would you like the next generation of forestry professionals to know about contract forestry, about anything?
Well, I'd like them to know that contract forestry is a viable option. In my 6 years of college, I'll be it only three of them were in the College of Natural Resources. I'd never even heard of contract forestry or working as a contractor. You know, maybe a consultant was brought up, but mm-hmm. I had no clue the scope and depth of the federal and state contracting that goes down, and private, right? Mm-hmm. Most of the private stuff's taken up by those large consulting firms, but there's so much work out there that you can do as an independent contractor. I had no clue of that whole world until I took that job on an email.
Like your sketchy job posting.
Yeah.
You know, maybe it's because I was an urban forester and not like a forest, true forest major.
But it sounds like you took all those classes where they went up, brought it up.
And I was, my friend who I mentioned who's head of timber, he was president of the forestry club. And so we were hanging out all the time. And
you would have had a clue had it been in that, whatever.
Never had heard of it. So there are opportunities outside of the usual paths. And obviously pursue what most interests you. But if you hit a dead end and you feel like there's no other way to go, well, there are options to work, to do field work. Most of the field work is, I shouldn't say most, but in terms of forest measurements,
mm-hmm.
most of the field work is done by contractors.
Yeah, it's been moving like that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably only going to get bigger.
Right?
I would think.
You would think. There is a lot of work out there that needs to be done.
Well, thanks for sitting down with us, Kyle.
Yeah, this was awesome.
Yeah, this was fun.
Good stuff.
Happy to share. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Make sure to like and subscribe at Decades on Dirt Roads Pod. And if you need any more information on the folks we interviewed or need a skull cleaned by Lily, make sure to check out the show notes. Again, thanks for listening. We appreciate you guys, and make sure to get outside.